morning, first morning of classes at Harbor, the Pepperdine Bible Lectures. I'm Jeff Childers, and we really appreciate that you turned out this morning for our class. This is the start of a series that we're doing 3 days called Tall Tales of a Lethal Sort. So I hope you're in the place that you meant to be in, because that's what this is. A minute ago, the gentleman who was helping us set this up said, "You must be Professor Allen. I'm glad you're here. Let's get started." And I don't know if you meant Leonard Allen or someone else maybe, but if we do see an Allen come in a little later and he's meant to take over, well, we're not going to let him. But we're glad you're here this morning to be with us for Tall Tales of a Lethal Sort.
So we're calling our class Tall Tales of a Lethal Sort, but what do we mean by tall tales?
Well, tall tales, you know what those are, right? These are stories that often have a lot of truth to them. They're based on truth, or they started as true stories, but they've gotten stretched, a little bit exaggerated. Or maybe some parts have been left out to make it a better story, but they're partly true and partly not true.
Okay, so tall tales are kind of like the stories that you would tell when I was younger to get me to do chores on the weekends, right? My name is Joel Childers. Jeff is my father. And when my sisters and I were younger, he would always get really creative when it came time to do chores on the weekends. You know, he'd wake us up early on Saturday morning and he'd say, "Okay, guys, we've got to go out and defeat the enemy. There's an enemy we've got to go defeat." And so he'd get us ready, and we'd line up at the back door, and he'd be given hand signals like he was on the SWAT team, and we'd sprint outside to go, you know, defeat the enemy, which would turn out to be like some Johnson grass in the back garden, and we'd spend the rest of our day pulling weeds. Is that what you mean by tall tales?
So that not only was that really important family bonding time, but it was a lot of fun, right? I mean, we were doing something important. But yeah, kind of, that's sort of what I mean by tall tales. Tall tales often serve an important function. They get things done.
Yeah, that one taught me that I always need to wear gloves when I'm pulling Johnson grass. Yeah.
Bingo, that's right.
But some of them didn't seem quite as effective. Like, on road trips, the way the connection between what he said was happening and what was actually happening was always kind of fuzzy.
You know,
it seems like the answer to the question, you know, how much farther do we have, was pretty much always, "Oh, 5 more miles," even though that was pretty much never true. Some tall tales seem like they don't have quite as much of a point.
Now, that one, that's a good one. 5 more miles. It was always true. There was at least 5 more miles left in the trip.
Sure.
Calculating how much to go, I mean, that was a big sort of math problem. And it was a lot easier just to say, "Well, kids, we've got about 5 more miles." And then they would stop asking over and over again how much farther we had, because they knew it was at least 5 more miles,
did
right?
Did they actually stop asking?
No, well, that's the problem. Sometimes these tales don't actually do any good, but it didn't do any harm.
Yeah, okay, maybe so. And maybe those were not too harmful, but sometimes tall tales can actually be kind of harmful. Like in football, the idea that head injuries aren't that serious. People can bounce back pretty quickly from head injuries, right? Well, maybe that's partly true, but we've learned recently that concussions actually have some pretty serious long-term effects. Or the tale that vaping isn't that bad for you, because at least you're not smoking cigarettes. So, okay, maybe vaping isn't as bad as cigarettes, but neither of those things are really healthy. Or the tall tale that race relations in America are great. Well, we've made some progress. Sure, they're better than they were 50 years ago or 100 years ago, but we kind of have a long way to go. And if we lean too much into that truth that race relations are great without realizing that we still have a long way to go, we won't make the progress that we need to make. So these tall tales are things that are partly true, sure, but if we lean too heavily into them, then often they can be pretty damaging to our lives and to our community.
Yeah, that's right. So this is why we're calling them tall tales of a lethal sort. This can happen in church too, right? For instance, in my church, I might come to realize that our church needs to be adaptable, needs to flex in order to meet new challenges that come up. And so I might start sort of looking for those new things that we need to do and be. But that can also make me susceptible to one of the tall tales we're going to talk about actually tomorrow that has to do with new things. that new things are better things. Of course, some new things are better things, but not all new things are better things. But if I keep telling myself that over and over again, then eventually I'm going to start living like that's the truth. That's always the truth. New things are always better. That's the kind of tall tale that we're talking about that has the sort of power to become our deep assumptions and to shape deep down the beliefs that we have that will affect our priorities. They affect things that we say, things that we do. A lot of times we're not really aware of them. We're not conscious of them. These are the kinds of things that are operating at a pretty deep level and sort of like instincts in a way. Well, how did those things get there? Well, there's probably a lot of different answers to that, kind of how these stories get into our hearts and our lives and our habits. But one way of looking at it is to think about them as stories. Think about them as stories that we buy into. We buy into them partly because there are aspects of them that are true or needful, but we do that maybe without thinking about it, without doing enough soul searching, or maybe without listening to the instincts of other people who say, wait a minute, that doesn't sound right, but we just sort of bulldoze over them because we know there's this thing about the story that's true that we need to go with. Then we buy into that story, and it becomes the only thing that that we're concerned with, and that's when these stories can do damage, and that's why we say these can be tall tales of a lethal sort. Now, it's possible that using the word lethal is slightly dramatic, right? But how else are we going to get you here at 8:30, right? When there's like 15 other sessions with lots of other great teachers and you're here. But they do damage.
Yeah, and this week we want to focus on three specific tall tales that we think can be really damaging in our spiritual lives and in our church communities. Today we're going to be talking about the tale that I need to keep my options open, that our lives are going to be better if we keep our options open and we don't commit too firmly to any one thing. And sure, it might be partly true that it's good to have options and it's good to have some freedom, but it isn't actually better for our lives or for our communities if we don't know how to practice commitment.
Yeah, and another tall tale is the one I was just talking about a minute ago. You need an upgrade. That's what we call it. You need an upgrade. Kind of recognizing that in our culture, in our society, there's this obsession with things that are new, obsession with innovation and novelty, and the tendency to want to trade old things out because they seem limited or they have flaws or they have problems for brand new things. And sometimes we let that tall tale have way too much power over us. It's certainly the case that some new things are better than old things, and some old things need to be traded out. But it's also the case that living the Christian life is something you have to do out of the tradition. And if you can't sort of deal with the tradition of the Christian life and of Christian community, the church, that's going to take you in strange directions.
Yeah, and the last tall tale we're going to be talking about on Friday is one that we're calling The Main Thing Is. Our culture pushes us to oversimplify, sometimes even really complicated things, so we can just kind of click like and be done with it. And in church, being simple can help us to focus on our values and our priorities, but it can also lead us to really oversimplify some really important things, things about God, about the life of faith, about church community. And when we do that, we have a tendency to focus on one main thing and exclude maybe some other equally important things. And also when we do that, we have a tendency to mistreat other people who don't share our main thing because we're viewing everyone and everything through the lens of our primary focus.
Yeah, that's right. That sounds good. It's fun to be doing this with you. You know, Joel, he's my son. He brings a lot of street cred, right, to my so he's so much younger than I am. It's a lot of fun to be doing this with you and talking about these things. Where do these things come from? Well, different places, but where the three tall tales we're going to be focusing on are powerful myths in our culture. It's just a part of this culture, a part of this society. It's in the air that we breathe. And so that's how they become instinctual to us, is because it's all around us, and there are all kinds of things that reinforce it. And one of the things we want to, one of the guiding principles that we're going to be using as we look at this is an awareness that sometimes the thing you believe in is not necessarily the thing that you say you believe in. It's the thing that you practice. And sometimes we're better at saying, well, I believe this and I believe that, than we are at actually implementing those things in practices and habits. So we're going to be kind of keep coming back to our practices. So speaking of practices, I'm going to launch into this first tall tale. I need to keep my options open. By taking us all the way to Christmas. How many shopping days are there till Christmas?
I have no idea.
It's not enough, whatever it is,
there's
right?
There's an app for that you can get.
Yeah, there is probably an app for that. Christmas time. Christmas shopping has changed a lot over the years, right? Back in my day, people would congregate at the mall to buy something for their loved ones. These days, when you're buying Christmas presents, I mean, there may still be some of us who go to the mall, but what's our preferred way to buy presents for someone at Christmas time?
Amazon,
online, yeah, absolutely. So how do I decide which online vendor, what online store I want to use? I want to buy some shoes for someone I love. So where do I go? You know, do I go to Zappos.com? Do I buy it from Dillard's.com? Do I buy it from DSW's online store? Where do I go? Well, there are some factors in play. First of all, I want to go buy it at a place that has the style I want, the size I want. Price is going to be a factor. I want to be sure that this thing can arrive by December 24th or tomorrow, you know, right? So these are all factors. But when I'm buying a Christmas present for somebody from an online store, what's another thing that I'm really concerned about? Is it as advertised? The price, of course, is an important thing. Yes, that's right. And can I return those shoes? That's a huge factor, right? I want to be able to return them. I want to be able to return them without penalty, if at all possible. In other words, I want to be able to back out of my decisions. And it's almost become a right I feel entitled to. And I'm only interested in the kinds of decisions I can make that are decisions I can back out of. I want to be able to hold my commitments very loosely. Now, that's kind of, you know, those are high-sounding words for shoe shopping. But the thing is, the shoe shopping and a lot of other things that we do are the places where we reinforce these assumptions until they become a part of our instincts. This is one of the most pervasive myths of our culture, that my life will be better if I keep my options open. Because if I commit to something, it may not turn out as advertised, right? If I commit to a group of people, they might let me down. What if I change my mind? What if something better comes along? I want to kind of build my life in such a way that I can keep my options open, I can stay free. Sometimes we don't even realize how deeply we're buying into this myth. It's just kind of a guiding assumption. I need to be able to back out of the decisions that I make, because those shoes may not fit.
Yeah, I know I can confess that I have a hard time. I struggle with buying into this myth. And it often makes me a really bad decision maker. When I was proposing to my wife, it took me weeks, maybe even months, to pick out the perfect engagement ring. And it wasn't because she wanted something that was especially unique or especially elaborate. It was just because I was afraid if I bought a ring today, then tomorrow I'd see one that I liked better. But it would be too late because I would have already committed to that first one. And that fear of commitment and the inability to make a decision was paralyzing. And I couldn't do anything because I was afraid if I committed to something, it wouldn't pan out the way that I wanted it to.
Right, but you just mean with the ring, right?
Right, yes, just the
ring. It's
right.
Not gonna pan out.
Yes, yeah. Just the ring. But I'm not the only one who does this. This thing is trending. The Pew Research Center and the Barna Group are groups that track religious trends in the United States. And they've been especially interested lately in what they're calling the rise of the nuns. And I know the rise of the nuns sounds like either a really interesting action movie or kind of a boring documentary, but we're talking about nuns, N-O-N-E-S. These are people who, when asked to check their religious preference on a survey, would check the box that says none. They're not Christians. They're not Muslims. They're not Hindus, often not even atheists. They're not committed to any religion in particular. And those numbers of people that would check none are climbing. In 2017, about 60% of Americans said that they're spiritual or they're religious or both. But about 34% said that they were no religion in particular. So these are people who believe in some sort of a spirituality, but they aren't really interested in committing to any particular religious group. And looking at the five-year trends, these numbers are continuing to climb. The number of people who would check none and the number of people who are spiritual but not religious. And there's a lot of reasons for this. There's a lot of reasons these numbers are going up. But if you spend much time working with teenagers or with college students, you'll know that one of the reasons is just a hesitance to commit to anything. You know, I was the president of my social club in college, and one of the hardest parts of that job was trying to get an RSVP from a college student. They don't want to commit because they know if they commit, well, then I'm going to expect them to be there. And if something better comes along, well, they're going to feel guilty if they back out. They're really afraid of commitment. And I'm sure that you know young people who act in similar ways, and you know young people who are terrible decision makers. And what you might not know is that it's not just because they're indecisive, and it's probably not because they just don't care, even though that's probably what they tell you it was about. It's really because they're afraid if they commit to something, it won't pan out the way they want it to. If they commit to something, something better will come along, or that thing might not turn out to be, you know, the best thing. And this fear of commitment ranges from everything from choosing an apartment to rent to choosing a school to go to or a church to commit to or choosing where to go to lunch. It covers all aspects of life. It's why smartphone apps like Urban Spoon caught on so much. I don't know if you remember Urban Spoon. I think it's got a different name now, Zomato or something.
Yeah, Urban Spoon. That was so last week. You got to keep up, man.
Yeah, so 2016, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right.
But Urban Spoon was an app that would pick a restaurant for you. You just punched in your location and your price range, and you shook your phone, and it would pop up with a restaurant. So you didn't have to make any sort of decision yourself. The phone would do it for you. You didn't have to commit to something and take that risk that your commitment might not pan out.
That sounds like a way to solve a lot of potential arguments, you know, with yeah. with my wife. It's just right. Say, well, let's just let the phone decide what we're going to do, where we're going to go. So what we're talking about is how these things were just kind of deep baked into the culture. We need to keep our options open. That's how we feel. And where some of these things are coming from and how that they're not entirely helpful. We're reluctant to commit because it puts limits on us, and we have these assumptions that we'll be safer, we'll be happier if we can stay free. But this is a tall tale. It is not true. You are not going to be happier. Your life is not going to be better because you're in the habit of keeping your options open. Dan Gilbert wrote the book Stumbling on Happiness, and he talks about this. There are psychological studies that show that people who make sure their decisions are reversible are not actually happier with those decisions. They're not happier with those decisions. You're not happier with the shoes you chose, the job you've got, the apartment that you've rented. If you're always second-guessing that choice, or you're spending a lot of energy and a lot of attention shopping around to see what other better options there might be. Choices that you can back out of do not actually make you feel better about those choices. And the studies show that you actually perform better and are happier with the choice once you feel like it's a settled choice. Not an open-ended thing, but something that you're committed to. So you move on. Instead of fretting over whether it was the right choice, and instead of diverting a lot of attention to shopping around and seeing what else there might be, you put your energy in on kind of moving on with life and working out the choice. And that actually turns out to be the main thing that will determine whether or not something works, how well you work it after you've made the choice. What you do with the choice that you have committed to is a more consistent predictor of the success of that choice and your happiness with the choice than the choice you made itself. And this is true with big things, too. This is true in marriage. Choosing the right person is important. But really, what you do with that choice and how you work out that commitment in the relationship over years is going to be a much larger predictor of the quality of a relationship with another person than the choice you happen to make at the front end. And maybe that's true even with an engagement ring, right? Now, when we talk about faith and kind of look at that through these lenses, having pulled the curtain back a little bit on this assumption we have about needing to keep my options open, that this is going to be a better way to go through life, it's a problem because faith is all about commitment. And if we're people who practice keeping our options open, that's something that can throw faith off balance in a lot of ways. And we could talk about a lot of different ways that that's the case. But today, what we want to do for the rest of our time is focus on how this cultural myth affects one thing in particular, and that is faith community and church, and how that some of what we most want and sort of are entitled to as the children of God in church will absolutely constantly elude us if we don't commit to it. So Anthony Giddens is an author who analyzes the ways that contemporary society impacts the health of community in our society. And he talks about something that he calls thoroughgoing reflexivity. Thoroughgoing reflexivity. What he's talking about are these habits we acquire because lots of information is coming in all the time. Choices are coming in, options are coming in all the time. We're learning about new things, and we're being given the opportunity, even encouraged, to kind of wake up each morning and reassess all of our commitments, renegotiate all of our relationships to everything. That's just a part of our society. So what toothpaste am I going to use this week? Right? What phone plan am I going to buy this year? This is sort of thoroughgoing reflexivity. And this business of feeling like we should and certainly enjoy the privilege of renegotiating all our commitments and relationships affects us in a lot of ways. And it's not just lighter things like toothpaste choices and phone plans. It's also, well, what church do I want to be a part of this year? Or what spouse makes the most sense for this season of my life? Giddens says that in our culture, we're all about this reflexive project of the self, which is supposed to preserve individual freedom. I've got to be me, and I've got to be free. But all it really does is make us feel perpetually less secure, less confident in who we are. We're not sure what our identity is, and we have difficulty finding any meaning in our lives. So we turn to our relationships to help us out. Maybe a relationship with a spouse, a significant other, relationship with a particular group of friends, relationship with people in a church, right? But here's the thing. When we approach those relationships, because of the impact of this tall tale on our hearts, we want to be able to say, look, I am choosing to be in this relationship because I want you to help me feel like I count. I want you to help me feel like my life has meaning. I want you to help me find a place in this chaotic mess of the world. But let's get some things straight. I'm not making any commitments to this thing. I'm not committing. There are not going to be any strings attached. And I have to be allowed to be as involved as I want to be. And I have to be able to trade you in if I get tired of it or if something else comes along. I don't want to be saddled with any obligations. I have to be myself. And that's the kind of thing that this myth is protecting in our culture, being myself and being free. The irony is we're so hungry for these good relationships, authentic relationships in church, in our families, but hedging our bets in all these ways really undercuts the possibility of having good relationships and good community.
Yeah, and discipleship is about good relationships and good community. I mean, what is the church but a community of disciples that are committed to Christ and committed to one another? And discipleship is and always has been about commitment. In Matthew 16, Jesus tells his disciples, "If anyone to become my followers, let them deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. For those who want to save their life will lose it, and those who lose their life for my sake will find it. Becoming a disciple means making a real, serious commitment. At the end of Luke 9, several people come up to Jesus and say they want to be his follower. And he says things to them like, you know, let the dead bury their own dead. Or anyone who puts a hand to the plow and turns back is not fit for service in the kingdom of God. And those sound like really harsh things to say, but he's just trying to be real with them. He's trying to let them know that discipleship is about real, serious commitment. It's all about asking them if they're counting the cost of what they're getting into. In Luke 14, he says, who starts a building project without counting the cost of it first? He says, do you know what this is going to require of you before you get into it? He doesn't lower the bar to make it easier for people to get in. He hits people with commitment hard, and he hits people with commitment early on, and he wants to make sure that they know exactly what they're getting into. He asked James and John, can you drink the cup that I'm going to drink? Can you be baptized with the baptism that I'm going to be baptized with? He's asking them if they're willing to do what it takes to be his follower. You know, when Jesus shares the Last Supper with his disciples, he talks about that in terms of a covenant. It's a binding commitment, a binding agreement between Jesus and his disciples. And if I'm the kind of person who thinks I need to keep my options open, then the church and Christianity just won't make sense to me. When Jesus tells his disciples to love each other, that's a commitment. When he tells them to wash each other's feet, that's a commitment. And his disciples are supposed to be a body. They're supposed to be a temple tied together. You know that early church in Acts chapter 2, the one that met together every day and shared all things in common? Those were people that were deeply committed to one another. And if we claim to be interested in recapturing the model of church that those early Christians had for us, one of the places that starts is with being willing to commit to one another. And I know that our first commitment has to be to God and to Jesus as Lord. But pretty often we say that just as a way of getting out of commitments to other people. And we can't do discipleship if we aren't committing to other people. We see time and time again in the Gospels, Jesus is about creating community and then challenging that community to be his kind of community. There's no discipleship without commitment to community. And the popular sort of individualized version of discipleship that we often tell ourselves, it's just about a relationship between me and God. That's all it's about. That is not really taking its cues from Scripture. It's taking its cues from the myths of the culture.
Yeah, so you said, if I'm the sort of person who wants to keep my options open, then what the church is really about is not going to make sense to me, or Christianity is not really going to make sense to me. And I think that's true. Although what can also happen is that I can change Christianity and change church and expectations of the church, so then it will make sense to the culture in this way by lowering all those bars and by hiding commitment challenges maybe way in the background. Because what the culture wants is that for the church to serve this reflexive project of the self. That's what it wants the church to do. The problem is you're on a dead-end track, you know, if you do that, because you keep holding out promises with one hand and then tearing apart the structures that would make those promises deliverable with the other hand. Well, structures like what? Structures like tradition, which we're going to talk about some tomorrow, right?
Yeah, that's the plan.
Yeah. So we talk about that tomorrow. Structures like tradition. Structures like making clear expectations. What do we expect from each other? Let's talk about that. Structures like accountability. How do we hold each other accountable as followers of the Lord in community together? Structures like a call to sacrifice myself for the sake of others. Structures of commitment. These are all things you do not want if you feel the need to keep your options open. They're all things Jesus requires. And they're all things that are necessary in order to have authentic community, really any kind of community, but certainly church community. So people crave community. They crave authentic community. The irony is, sometimes we think, well, I don't want to invest in that thing until I know for sure exactly how it's going to pan out. And I get that instinct, that kind of self-preservation instinct. But you can't actually know how community is going to pan out without investing in it. And this is how Jesus was with his disciples. He just like you said, he challenged them to follow him. He challenged them to make a commitment and then to follow through on that commitment. They were willing to do that. They learned things about what the community was. And they stuck with him and formed a distinctive kind of community. And that could only happen because of the commitment. So I'm not really qualified to pass judgment on whether the community is really worth investing in until I've made a little investment in it. And I think that's one of the reasons why the early church tried to encourage people to make that investment early on so they could learn what it was really all about. They didn't lead with, hey, we're not going to expect anything from you when you show up here because we want you to feel comfortable. They led with, come and die with us. You know, which is a pretty robust thing. That's why some of the trends these days, Joel, are a little baffling to me, especially with younger people. You can help us understand this maybe better. I don't know what generation we're in. We're way past Gen X and the millennials. We're calling them Gen Y, I-millennials, or no, it's the I-generation, post-millennials.
I have no
idea. Or is
idea.
It I-post, yeah. And I don't know.
Yeah.
Okay, so we've got different names for the different generations, but it seems to me that young people these days are really eager to find authentic community, and they crave that, but they're reluctant to commit. So what's the deal?
I agree with you. I think that young people are, in general, reluctant to commit for reasons that we've talked about. They're afraid that something better will come along later. They're worried that if they commit to something, it won't pan out properly. But every new generation has, for the last few decades, every new generation has been feeling more isolated, more insecure, more anxious than the generation before it. And I don't think that that all started with us.
Hey, now.
I don't think that it's all on us. I think we learned a lot of it from you guys. You know, I think, sure, young people are scared to commit to institutions like the church, but in my experience, just signing on the dotted line for church membership hasn't actually always led to the kind of radical commitment that Jesus seems to be calling his disciples to. Let's be honest about this. A lot of people my age and younger and a little bit older grew up without having much commitment modeled for them. They grew up as latchkey kids. They grew up disconnected from their extended family, often disconnected from their nuclear family as a whole. The life that they had modeled for them was one where what was better was going to determine major life decisions, not following through on commitments. And even if our families did sort of sign on the dotted line for church membership, that didn't mean that they weren't going to prioritize moving up the career ladder or job opportunities or money over that commitment to a faith community. So, yes, I think that the older generations may look a little bit more committed than young people, but I don't know if in reality that's always actually the case. You say you don't know if you can count on us, but I'm wondering, can we actually count on you?
See, that's... See, it's at this point I'm trying to decide whether doing this together was a good idea. And we kind of talked about this, but you know, hearing you say it, it's a little more convicting. Okay, so it's this is partly a trust problem.
Yeah.
I mean, younger people not convinced that they can trust us and maybe trust the community that we represent and what we're asking of people when we're sort of dealing trickily behind our back and not committing in the way that you're talking about.
Yeah, and this trust issue seeps even into our church communities. It's not just our family life. One summer, I was working as a youth intern at a church, and at the beginning of the summer, we sat down in the youth minister's office to sort of plan out recruiting for volunteers for the activities that we were going to have that summer. And we were going to be, you know, making announcements in Bible class and sending out emails and putting blurbs in the bulletin and all those sorts of things. And we were working on the wording of those announcements. And one of our main priorities was making sure that it didn't sound like we were making too big of an ask. So we would say things like, you know, come try it out, and if it's not for you, that's fine, no pressure. Or, you know, we're only asking for as much time as you're able to give. Or, you know, we'd really like some help, but if it's not for you, no worries. We understand. We know you're busy. And what we really wanted was a serious commitment to these young people, but we were afraid to ask for that because we didn't want to scare people off. And I'm sure that some of you have been a part of that kind of bait and switch in youth ministry where you think that you're committing to show up on Sunday morning from time to time and be in Bible class, and before you know it, you're like the chaperone of a middle school lock-in, and you realize that you've been duped. But it's because youth ministers and a lot of people that are recruiting volunteers in churches are afraid to ask for the kind of commitment that they actually want and the kind of commitment that they actually need. And no, this doesn't mean that we should commit to everything the church asks us to do. You know, we can talk about the ways that we need to set healthy boundaries for ourselves. We can talk about the fact that some churches may be just doing a little bit too much. We can talk about the 80-20 rule. You know, I'm sure that some of you in here are the 20% of people that are doing the 80% of work. We can talk about all those things, but this morning what we're trying to focus on is our commitment phobias and how those things are undermining our community. So no, we're not saying we should all be committing to everything that the church asks us to commit to blindly without being critical. We are saying that we need to look in ourselves and see, is our fear of commitment because of the thing we're being asked to commit to, or because we've allowed this myth to seep into our lives? Now, I know youth ministry, so we can take that as an example. Not being able to commit isn't better for youth ministries. You know, all the research tells us that the biggest factor in the formation of youth is the committed presence of adults in their lives. Even more important than contemporary worship or pizza on Wednesday nights or fun and exciting trips, more important than any of those things is the committed presence of adults in young people's lives. And we know that this is true, right? A lot of us, if we look back to our early years, we can see that the people who are most influential in our faith walk were not necessarily the people who had the coolest cars. They were not necessarily the people who taught the best Bible classes, people who had the wisest or the funniest things to say. More often than not, the people who are most influential in our lives were the people who were simply there. Week in, week out, they showed up no matter what, and they didn't allow anything to come in between them and that commitment. But a lot of young people just don't get to experience that unless older people commit. Young people don't learn how to commit if older Christians don't model that for them.
So this series, this Tall Tales of the Lethal Sort, this is a series about some of the common beliefs and assumptions that shape us, often because we're just part of a particular culture. It's not a series on quick and simple strategies, you know, the five easy steps to kind of taking care of these things. Sometimes I think we need to step back and look at these deep things, the deep assumptions that are informing our practices, and kind of pull the curtain back on those so that we can be honest about those and so that we can be confessional about those. And I think about what you said a minute ago when you made it very concrete and you said, well, if, you know, someone's not willing to show up to do something with a youth group, then it makes you wonder about commitment. And we can think of 1,000 different, responses to that along the lines of, well, you know, it's not about the organization, it's not about the institution, it's not about church, or I'm not a better or worse Christian because I don't show up for a youth event or something like this. We can think of a ton of excuses, but these are all blinders that keep us from identifying something which is still true. And that is, we have difficulty with commitment. Yeah. And there are other ways to concretize that than the specific examples we're giving. But underneath it all, there is this myth flowing at work. There are some practical things, even though we're talking about deep myths, deep assumptions. But there are some practical things. And one is simply, first of all, to do the kind of soul searching we're sort of doing here this morning. You know, to ask ourselves some questions. If it's for me to step back and be honest with myself and ask myself, what are the commitments that I've been practicing? And what order do they fall into? Now, what commitments am I practicing? That's different from what commitments did I say. You know, because often I practice a different set of commitments than I think I have. When someone asks, well, what are your number one commitments? And I've got a verbal list and it's in my mind, and that's important. But if I ask the question, what are the commitments that I practiced this week or last year? Some of those answers are going to be a little different than the other. And I need to kind of step back and say, am I letting this tall tale hurt my investment in Christian community? That's what I need to do, a little soul searching, be somewhat confessional about it. Another thing sort of flows out of that, and that is to do an audit, kind of audit the practice of commitment in my life, to step back, kind of look at a time period for a week or a month or whatever, and just look at those practices more closely. And you need a certain eye to see it, right? What are the things that you're actually practicing commitment to? Okay, those are the things that you don't reschedule for something else. Those are the things that are most likely to move to the top of the list, least likely to be bumped by something else. Whether we're talking about time commitment or our schedule or our budget or just the energy of our attention, you know, again, that's sort of acquiring the eyes to see what the practices are that we're committing, but to audit those things and kind of list what my practices are so that I can be honest and confessional before God. I don't know what my commit. I mean, I hope I can have a sense of what mine should be. I don't know what yours should be, and certainly don't know what all the commitments of the people and all the congregations represented here should be. But this is a helpful process to kind of reflect on this, because those things, whatever they are, whatever the things are that I'm least likely to cancel and most likely to bump other things for, those are the things that are running like a thread through my months, my years. Those are the things that are going down deep like roots that provide a kind of life to me and a certain direction for who I am. Now, sometimes at our church, they'll call somebody out on a Sunday morning who's had a big anniversary. Right? You may do this too. 50 years or 60 years or 75 years, and everybody applauds because it's amazing, you know, for a 75-year anniversary. It's awesome, and it's very special. And you think, wow, how does someone get to 60 years of marriage? Well, these people tell you it's not magic so much. It's mostly about following through tomorrow on the commitments that you made yesterday. It's mostly the small things. Now, there are some mountaintop moments and there's some deep valley moments, but it's mostly every day practicing commitment to each other, habits of prioritizing one another over other things, week in and week out. It's laying one brick on top of another, on top of another. And sometimes we get so sort of obsessed, especially in our spiritual lives, with things that really strike us as dramatic and deep and powerful and important because they're mountaintop or the volume on them is real loud or they're technicolor, you know, like Stauffer Chapel is. And those things are important. Those are watershed moments. But the far more important things are the spiritual disciplines that you're keeping every day and every week, every month. And even as I say these words, I feel convicted by my own slippage in daily disciplines. But it's tough because in church, a lot of us have become so afraid of sounding legalistic. That's one thing. So we don't want to emphasize practices. You know, that there are things you should be doing. Wait a minute, that makes me sound legalistic. I don't want to say that. I take it back. Actually, we don't want you to do anything. You know, you're saved by grace. Or, you know, there are all kinds of kind of ways we go there. But what we end up doing is completely undermining expectation of practices. Even though the things that you do with your schedule and with your budget and with your body and with your inner, you know, your attention, those form the fabric out of which discipleship is made and out of which Christian community occurs. But we're kind of afraid because we don't want to be legalistic, so we forget to emphasize practices. Or maybe we don't want to seem judgmental. So we don't want to lay expectations on people and hold people accountable. And frankly, if the deal we can work out is that you won't hold me accountable either, then it's a pretty convenient answer. But this isn't how discipleship works. So this is why, here's another sort of practical thing that some people do, and that is to hammer out a rule of life. A rule of life. What's a rule of life? It's basically a statement of principles that will be the things I am committed to in my life. What are my priorities? What will be my guiding principles week in and week out when I make decisions, when I make other commitments? What are the things I'm most committed to? It's basically a kind of covenant between me and God. But people also do it in other ways. Couples put together rules of life. Families will have a rule of life. What are the rules? What are the principles by which we'll have life together? What are the habits? What are the priorities that will guide us? And people prayerfully put this together. Ministry teams do this. Elderships sometimes will do this. We could do a whole class on kind of rules of life. There's a lot of help online. There's some books about this. But the point is, one practical thing is to sit down and actually have a concrete conversation about what our commitments are going to be and what they're going to look like. At home in our church, our elders have said this year one of the things they want to reflect on is what it means to be a member. What it means to be a member of this body of Jesus Christ in this place, in this congregation. And for a long time, that's the kind of thing that people just sort of taken for granted. You know, well, we know exactly what it means to be a member. And then there are aspects of that that seem kind of difficult and awkward in different ways. And so that got underemphasized and then maybe fell out of view. And our elders have realized that not being more clear about what the life is that we want to share together and what we expect of people who are committed members of this body, it's not actually helping anybody. It's not helping the people in it. It's not helping people who might be in it, who are thinking about it. To be more explicit about those things can be a powerfully redemptive process of discernment that can help build some life-giving structures of commitment in a church family.
Yeah, for our family, when I was growing up, part of what it meant to be committed to a church family was we were going to be there whenever a church was doing something. We were going to be there on Sunday morning. We were going to be there on Wednesday night. We didn't do Sunday night. We weren't crazy, but we were going to be there when the church was open. And that taught me that part of the life of a disciple was gathering on Sunday morning with other disciples and worshiping, or gathering on Wednesday night and studying the Bible, or going on mission trips, or gathering with a small group. And it didn't make me resentful. It didn't make me hate my faith or hate the church or hate my family. It kind of molded these rhythms into the fabric of my life. And it became just a part of who I was and a part of the way I viewed the world. And when I was a kid, it seemed pretty simple how we were going to make decisions. When the choice was between God and baseball, God and soccer, God and homework, God and whatever, we were going to choose God. And now that I'm older, I realize that the decisions typically aren't that simple. They're not that straightforward. You're not choosing between God and something else. It's not as easy as that. But this was a way that my parents trained me to choose God. And that was something that I often take for granted, but I'm so grateful for. And like I said, it didn't make me resentful or hate my family or hate the church. It's something I'm grateful for, that I had those rhythms embedded in my life from an early age, and I didn't really have much say in the matter. It wasn't about legalism. It was about practicing commitment.
Well, I appreciate your saying that. I want to point out there might have been a day or two when you expressed slight resentment. Even though you're saying you're not.
I don't know what you're talking about.
But yeah, since it sounded like you're more or less saying, we were great parents, I'm just going to take it. Yeah. You know, that's really great. I appreciate that. I don't know what's going to happen tomorrow, but we'll see. Well, this is another practical thing, honestly, especially for those of us who are parents or who are grandparents, and that is to give our kids and grandkids, or as much as we can, young people or young Christians that we have influence over, the capacities to practice commitment by encouraging them in that and by trying to help them hold themselves accountable before the Lord to these things. And, of course, you're right. Whether or not, you know, you went to church this one time rather than choosing this other thing another time, everything didn't, you know, hang on that, right? But learning that basic habit, those basic structures, provided the foundation from which maybe now we can discern a little better when to, you know, when to compromise on certain things in ways that are not kind of reneging on our commitments. But so we set discipleship goals and we follow through on those in our families and with our kids. Some days they're going to like it. A lot of days they're not going to like it. There were a few of those. Some days you are definitely not going to like it. That's part of what makes it a commitment. If all we're talking about, and this gets kind of at another myth of our culture, but it's related, is only doing the things that you choose to do and like doing, that's not really proving anything about whether you're committed. That just proves that you know how to pick the ice cream flavor you like. I'm not sure that there's any virtue in that. You know, it's when you choose things and follow through on them that you don't like, or that you find difficult, or that you're struggling with at the moment, this is where commitment starts to gain traction, and you begin to learn whether this thing is worth committing to or not, and how that's going to work. But you got to follow through to do it. These things are, it's just a simple thing, like, I'm showing up to be with the church family when they do things. It's actually a spiritual discipline. It's one of those bricks.
Yeah, and that's what we mean when we talk about being radical in our priorities. Like you said, we're not talking about all the mountaintop things necessarily, or all the watershed moments, or all the big dramatic things. Sometimes being radical in our priorities is just commitment. It's just a regular practice. You know, I think that young people need to see older Christians committing to God, choosing God over their job, choosing God over their recreation. And you see older Christians choosing to go to church even when there's other things going on, choosing to go on mission trips even if it's not to the most exciting location or they have to miss some work. And it's not because God is only at church or God is only on mission trips, but I think we need to start being honest with ourselves about what's happening when we choose one thing over another. And if we're all just too overextended all the time, then we need to be honest about why that is. It's not that church attendance or volunteering with the youth ministry is the end-all and be-all of Christianity, but how else are we going to teach and show others what it means to be a disciple? How else are we going to teach and show others that our priorities are something that we practice? And I'm really not trying to let young people off the hook. I think young people in general, people of my age, need to be a lot less quick to criticize things that they aren't willing to commit themselves to. There's been some interesting studies lately about how often people who are out protesting about hot button issues are not actually turning out to the voting booth on election day. And they're definitely not following through on all the action steps for their main thing. And the same thing happens in our churches. We have a lot of people, especially young people, who are quick to criticize the church. But if critics aren't invested, then it's really hard to take them seriously. And a lot of this has to do with the fact that too many of us see church as a them. It's an organization rather than an us, this family of believers that we're committed to. But if our main pitch to youth or to new members or potential members is all the cool things that we can offer them, if that's our main pitch, and we're not telling them that what we're really looking for is for them to come participate with us in the work of God's kingdom, then it's no wonder that that's how people view church. For our churches as a whole, just like Jesus did, we need to be willing to challenge each other. I've heard that people used to use words like commitment and faithfulness, even words like duty or obligation.
See, these seem like bad words.
Yeah, those aren't words that I've heard very much in church settings, except for maybe when people are preaching against those kind of words, preaching against legalism. But I think we need words like that. I think we need words that are going to challenge us. All our words don't have to be soft words. We need hard words, too, so we can talk about the kind of real things that discipleship is about. Things like faithfulness and commitment to each other and to God and to our neighbors. And we need to be able to hold each other accountable and be held accountable. When I don't show up to church on a Sunday and somebody asks me where I was, that can be a little bit annoying. But more than anything, it just tells me that I was loved and I was missed. And if the only response I can have when somebody tells me that I was missed is to get defensive, that probably says a lot more about me than it does about them being judgmental.
Well, we're gonna wrap here in a minute. Basically, what we're trying to do today is just to get us to think about this, get us to think about and be honest maybe with the deep influence of this myth on our decisions, on our lives. And we want maybe to help us all see that there are good reasons to advocate for commitment. That when you advocate for commitment in your family or in a church ministry, in the congregation, when you advocate for commitment and challenge people to that and talk in those terms, and maybe even we hold each other accountable to that, that's an antidote to some of what the culture is doing to undermine community in general, and certainly Christian community. Those instincts aren't necessarily narrow-mindedness or legalism or just, I think as you've illustrated well, not just serving the institution. We need to serve the institution, so we want to get people to make sure they're there. There are much deeper instincts, too, instincts that have to do with covenant in discipleship and how community actually works. Now, we know that commitment does not fix everything. Sometimes you commit to something and it does not pan out. Sometimes you commit to a group of people and they let you down. I'm looking out there and some of you are going, sometimes? I mean, nearly every group of people I've committed to has let me down. Well, that's right. Don't take it personally. It's the nature of human community. Committing does not guarantee that your community and your relationships will be good. But it is absolutely guaranteed that if you do not commit, they will not. Jean Vanier is a leader who formed the L'Arche communities, which were organized to bring in severely disabled people and help them, just care for them, help them get through life day in and day out. And doing that kind of a ministry showed him how redemptive communities like that can be, but also showed him how difficult they are and how much commitment is necessary. And that led him to reflect on the nature of community in our culture. And he said this: stop wasting time running after the perfect community. Live your life fully in your community today. So, the way to deal with a tall tale, which has a lot of falsehood to it, is to practice the truth instead. If I want to find real life in my community, I have to stop acting like somebody who wants to keep my options open. I need instead to practice commitment. How else are we going to offer the world an alternative community, a healthier community, a community that's not like the communities out there where people are constantly expecting to be able to reverse their decisions of commitment? How else can we offer them a community in which they can trust and find real health and healing and stability if it's not one grounded on commitment to Christ as Lord and to each other? Everybody wants that. Everybody wants healthy, rich, authentic community. But it's something that we have to practice. So we hope we've pointed some helpful directions regarding that. Now, tell us about what's coming next.
Yeah, we really hope that you'll start practicing a little bit of commitment by coming back tomorrow morning.
Yes, yeah, that's right. Don't let us down on the commitment thing. Yeah. I mean, honestly.
We'll be talking about the tall tale, You Need an Upgrade. The way our constant search for things that are new and innovative can lead us to forget about the importance of grounding our identity in tradition. And Friday, we'll be talking about the tall tale, One Main Thing, or The Main Thing Is, how we focus too much on one main thing and sometimes exclude other equally important things. So thanks again for being here. We hope that you'll join us for the rest of the week.
Blessings on the rest of your day.